Hello and welcome to another episode of The Meta. I'm your host, Jay Larson, and joining me this week, I'm very excited, we have Matt Wilson, one of the founders of Privateer Press. Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
Hi, Jay. Good. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. So usually at the start, we have people introduce themselves. I'm assuming anyone listening at this point knows who you are. And so let's just dive into the questions and get as much info as we can out to people.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. So these are all questions that have been submitted from the listeners, the patrons of the podcast. And I've put them up in categories and groups so that they're kind of in similar questions with each other. The first category we have is kind of community questions or general Privateer Press questions. So first question is, first, let me say these past 2 years have been very hard on many of us. So thank you and everyone at Privateer for giving us something to think about that is not the actual world at large. Now that life is returning to something resembling a normal, what are some things you're looking forward to doing or seeing again?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, as a company, we're excited to get back to conventions to be able to demo the games and have some face-to-face time with players. On a personal note, I'm looking forward to going back to the movies. Watching stuff on the big screen is one of the things I've really missed the most.
What are some of your favorite genres of movies?
Oh, genre movies. Anything with a star or wars in it. All the Marvel stuff, of course. So. Cool.
Next question. There's been a lot of great art created over the last 20 some odd years, but only a small amount can be ordered for prints. Is Privateer looking at working with print-on-demand vendors like InPrint or Displate to offer a wider range to fans?
It's not something that we have looked into, but it's something that maybe we should if there's, you know, if there's interest in prints of things that we don't currently produce. But I don't think that we will ever come close to being able to offer, you know, our entire library of artwork. We literally have thousands and thousands of pieces of artwork in it. So so we tend to offer, you know, pieces that we think are going to be iconic and, you know, attractive. So
next question, how will Privateer be putting out fiction for War Machine in the future? I personally really love the novels that were produced. Will we see the return of novels or annual book style? As much as I like the Henschel scrolls, I don't imagine that it's the most effective way to tell every story that you want to.
Henschel scroll was a fun experiment. It was actually inspired by a suggestion from Aaron Rudell, who used to work with Privateer and that we've done a lot of fiction with. And he regularly publishes a lot of what's called microfiction, which is short bites of fiction that are put out through tweets. But generally that microfiction is supposed to be contained to a single tweet or maybe two or three. So when we wanted to tell the story of the claiming and we had all these events going on all over Emerin, we thought that that would be a fun way to bounce all over the place and get a full view of how pervasive the event was. However, you know, as often happens, our ambitions exceeded the capacity of the medium, and the entries started getting bigger and bigger because the writers had so much that they wanted to tell. So it was a fun way to have daily drops of bite-sized fiction, and we enjoyed doing it as well as seeing the reactions, because each entry was kind of like its own mini cliffhanger. But it's actually a lot more difficult to orchestrate fiction that way than just straight up writing a conventional, you know, in a conventional format. So with the Thousand Worlds, we had we had some Kickstarter stretch goals there to produce fiction, and we made a series of short stories that we published online. And so we'll likely keep doing a lot of the fiction online in the future. But the Orgoth fiction that we've talked about doing with Aaron again in the future is planned as a digital publication. Tripping over my words there.
All right. So next question is, what has been the hardest struggle for Privateer Press during the pandemic? What has been your biggest success?
Think on that. I think we had the same sorts of challenges that the whole world experienced, you know, during the pandemic. We were all but shut down for several months. We had to learn to work remotely like everybody. We had to learn to work with kids in the house all day long, which is I think, at the top of everybody's list of challenges. And now we're still kind of trying to figure out what the new normal actually looks like. You know, it also didn't help that we were still in the middle of trying to recover from a huge company move to a new location, which had caused delays on other things when COVID came along. So we'd only been in our building for about 3 or 4 months, and we didn't even have everything put away. So that was we were sort of going from one set of challenges to a whole new set. But you know, we're still here, and I'd say, you know, one of the bigger successes was delivering Warcaster really close to when we had predicted it would deliver after we ran that Kickstarter, even though we were almost completely shut down for several months. And then just you know, getting back to work and moving forward with plans and being able to keep producing stuff.
Yeah, I obviously had to deal with the shutdowns as well. That was a challenge. I would imagine as a manufacturer, the supply chain and logistics stuff has probably just been a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, we've had all kinds of experience with that. You know, anybody who's producing anything overseas has had to deal with those supply chain challenges, and even stuff produced domestically is can be challenging, especially if you're relying on any sort of materials that come from anywhere else. But so, you know, I think that the good thing about it is, at least from our perspective, we found that people were very understanding and patient with those delays, because everybody was experiencing them everywhere. It wasn't something that was isolated or unique to anybody. And so I think it was a great amount of patience and understanding on the part of, you know, people waiting to get their hands on things.
So the next few questions are related to building community and supporting Privateer Press. The first one says, one of the things that has set Privateer Press apart from other game companies is their level of community building and interaction. With the pandemic, a lot of the streams and such has had to stop. Will you be bringing those things back online? Bringing Primecast back is a huge step in the direction. Is there more planned, like weekly streams?
You know, right now we're really focused on getting Primecast going again, and making sure that comes out every month. And Primecast Plus, which is also a monthly thing. You know, Primecast is focused on our sort of longer discussions and topics. And then Primecast Plus is sort of a short video that we want to produce every month. That'll be sort of a behind the scenes look at, you know, the things that we're doing, and more of a visual medium to kind of show, you know, what sculpts we've got coming up, what new artwork we're working on. And it's been fun to try and put those together, but we're, you know, we're only on episode 2 of Primecast Plus, and we just put out the second episode of Primecast. So we're going to be, just want to get those dialed in now over the next few months, and then we'll see where we go from there.
Next question is, if I want to get involved with Privateer Press and growing the community, what is the best way to do that? The Press Gang was such a great tool for that before, but with nothing to replace it, there seems to be little someone can do outside of being positive and fostering an open community that's friendly to new players.
You know, I mean, there's nothing keeping anybody from going into a store and running an event. You know, anybody can do that. Anybody interested in building community, in growing the number of players in their area, has that capability. And I bet you walk into any game store and tell the owner or manager that you'd love to run an event for a game, they will probably be thrilled. And so that's, you know, that's the way to do it if you really want to build community in your area.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'll say as a game store owner is that I carry so many products that it's impossible between the things that I'm interested in or my staff are interested in. There's just more products than items that we're personally interested in. And so one of the things that a good store has to try to do is, you know, find people who are evangelists for games and then do what they can to support them so that their excitement can go out to the community. And I realize that it can sometimes be a struggle to find a good game store, but I think that once you're able to find that, that's kind of the situation that you're looking for. So
Yeah, I mean, you gotta have a place to play, right? I mean, and if you're gonna grow community, you're probably not gonna do it on your kitchen table. You're gonna, you know, get out there in a game store or a club or something like that. But every game that has, you know, stood any test of time has done so because it had people who loved it and championed it and just wanted to introduce it to other people. And I think that's something that's really unique in our industry, in games in general, is that most of them require, you know, at least one other person to play with. And so so gamers are typically very passionate about these things, and we want to introduce the games to new people, and the more the better, because, you know, the more people that play the games you love, the more opportunity you have to be able to play them. So, you know, and then we offer organized play prize kits that stores can order. I think some of them are even available to order by players, and we're doing more of those in the future. So we'll have some pretty neat things for people who want to put together events, or, you know, just want to get out there and show the game off to people.
All right. So last community question, they say, apart from buying stuff, how can the community best support Privateer Press?
Get out there and play, you know, share what you're playing and what you're painting online. You know, we love seeing that stuff. And we love to share that with the community, teach somebody knew how to play the game. You know, we've all been shut in and cut off from each other for so long that I think we've forgotten how this works, but games are contagious, you know, in a good way. And if you're passionate about a game, you introduce somebody to that game, that passion rubs off on them, and pretty soon you've got somebody new to play with.
One thing I'll throw in as well is that I think a lot of people, one of the things they like about War Machine is that they can think about list building or think about or have contact with the game through social media while they're working or doing different things in their life. And I think everyone can make the conscious choice to be more positive on social media, and that we would all benefit quite a bit from that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole world would benefit if people were more, more positive on social media. So,
yes.
there's nothing unique here and going on with games. But yeah, I totally agree.
All right. So next category of questions is Monsterpocalypse. So the first one says, first off, congratulations with the super successful Kickstarter. What were some of the lessons you learned from that Kickstarter?
The Monsterpocalypse Kickstarter was very, very much Mythic's show. Like, we weren't really involved in building the Kickstarter or managing it or running it. They are experts at making board games and making Kickstarters, and so we sort of provided the product, right? And they did everything else, and it was great. You know, I mean, definitely we got to see how they, you know, they do it. We were paying close attention to it, and we've incorporated a few of the their methods into our future Kickstarter campaigns, but as far as, like, you know, big lessons, I don't think that there was something that I could say was a huge takeaway from that. It went very, very well.
The follow-up question is, are there any plans to have any more collaborations with Mythic?
No plans on the books right now. I love Mythic. I've known some of the people there since before Privateer even existed. So we've got a long, long history, and we had been looking for an opportunity to do something together for a long time, because we're both sort of, you know, fans of each other, and they're super awesome people to work with. So things lined up for Monsterpocalypse, and we did that project. I would jump at an opportunity to work with them anytime in the future, but we're both busy, very busy, and so something will have to line up for that again. But I'm sure that that, especially based on the success of the Monsterpocalypse Kickstarter, that I would think that there's a strong possibility that we could do something again in the future.
So next Monkpot question is, which factions are you looking at building out a little bit more?
Right now, the stuff on the drawing board, is We've got stuff coming for The Waste and for Green Fury. So we'll be filling out those factions. And then, you know, later this year, we've got Megaton Mashup 2 coming, the Battle of the Cons. So, and then after that, we'll see.
All right. So final Monpok question. Have you considered bringing Directrix and Zadaroth in as monsters for Monpok? That's where the gate set them with Cintharion's last minute change to the Monpokiverse.
All I'm going to say is everything is connected.
All right. So next set of questions are Riot Quest related. First one, will we see a new quote unquote season of Heroes coming out, or has your vision for Riot Quest releases changed?
The most recent plans definitely changed. So we're going to be moving forward with the Pests expansion. And then the next thing we'll focus our attention on is redesigning our approach to the board game version. We still would very much like to do. But that is most likely going to shape up like a new season. I think where our heads are right now is that we want to make sure that everything in the board game version is all new. And so, yeah, I think that's most likely to feel like a new season if people have been following along. It's not exactly where we thought we were headed right now, but sometimes you got to course correct and take a different path.
So would that most likely be a situation where if I'm currently a Riot Quest player, I could buy the board game, get new models, and use those models with the Riot Quest miniatures I already have?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of one of the pillars of the board game design is that it needs to be fully compatible with the current hobby version. So anything that we would make in there, you'd be able to use in with your existing collection. And then I think, you know, like I said, where we're thinking right now is that the board game version needs to be all new, so that the existing players who want to help back the project aren't buying something that's redundant for them.
Next Riot Quest question is, at one point story mode was discussed. Is that something that is still in the works, or has that project been shelved for now?
It's still something that we want to do, but it'll probably go in line after the board game version.
What's your favorite model to come out of Riot Quest?
Boy, that's a toss up between Leadfoot and Shreds and Helgon Wheels. I think those are both hilarious and amazing models.
I'd probably have to go with Leadfoot for myself. So last Riot Quest question is one that I had. I had heard, maybe this is more legend than fact, but I guess I'd like to verify. But I'd heard that kind of the design mandate for Riot Quest was that you wanted a game that you could play with your son and have it be you'd not feel like you have to throw the game in order to have an enjoyable time playing with him. I guess is that true? And if so, how has your son liked Riot Quest?
Yeah, he's definitely a part of the inspiration behind it. Because I think at the time he was about, let's see, I think 7 or 8 years old, and he was just a little young to get into Monster Apocalypse or War Machine at the time. And but he's always loved the miniatures and we've done some painting and stuff like that. But yeah, I was looking for something that that we could do together. And so he actually is the very first playtester for Riot Quest ever. I mocked up the game and sat him down and forced him to play.
Nice.
Sorry.
No, I said that's nice. That's cool.
Oh yeah. And he's 11. He's always been more into games on a screen than he has been games on a board. So, it was a little bit of arm twisting to get him to sit down and roll dice, but it was great. Yeah. And so, nice. Yeah, and he loves it. He loves all the characters and everything, and we have a good time.
All right. So our next questions are related to Warcaster. First one is, by the time of this recording, with luck, Warcaster Kickstarter 3 should start shipping out. Can you give some hints into the plans of what to expect for the next set of releases?
Yeah. So we actually, I'm not sure when you're planning on publishing this, but
right away.
Oh, okay. Well, we start shipping 1,000 worlds tomorrow. So it will we'll start with the international shipments first, as we always do, because they have the longest travel time. But yeah, we're gonna start sending that out the door tomorrow. And then all the domestic shipments will follow there. So that's great news. And then after that, what we've got in the works right now is a campaign product. And it was something that we had hinted at quite a while ago, that we wanted to do a campaign product. And we were going to originally that was going to be part of the Thousand Worlds project. But, you know, as things go for us, often our ambitions sort of took over and Thousand Worlds grew bigger than we expected. And within the scope and time frame that we were working, we didn't feel like we could sort of do justice to the campaign system in that time. So we put that as our next project, and that's what we're working on right now. And so I think we're hoping to be able to start showing that off probably this summer. So, you know, after the Thousand Worlds models and books deliver to backers, then we'll release all those models and everything to retail, and those will be coming out probably like June, July, August, and around that time we'll start showing off the campaign product and what we are planning to do with that.
So kind of a follow-up question on that, is, are all Warcaster releases going to be through Kickstarter initially, or will some be released outside of that model?
Yeah, no, not everything is going to go through Kickstarter. In fact, the campaign system that we're working on right now, that's not planned for a Kickstarter release. That'll be something that we just release conventionally.
Next question. Do you have any hints on what the Lost Legion are or where they come from?
Well, you got to read the Thousand Worlds Gone Wild fiction that Aaron Riddell wrote, because we put some big hints in there as to what to expect in the future of Warcaster. The Axel for Hire character is pretty important there. And at one point he belonged to something that was a lot bigger than, you know, what he's doing now. And he's seen a lot of stuff that few others have seen in the setting. So if you read those stories, you pick up on some hints and you probably put it together what's coming.
All right. So last Warcaster question is one for myself. So Warcaster is your most recently developed game. What would you say is the part of that game that works the best or that you're proudest of?
There's a lot of stuff that I really like about Warcaster. And I think it's hard to put my finger on one thing, but I'd say what we were trying to do was create a really different experience from War Machine, just so that it wasn't Space War Machine, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that we achieved that. It's a really, you know, not just because it's got different, you know, turn sequence activation or anything like that, but it's a really, really different experience. And when I was working on it with Jason Souls early on, as we sort of started to play test it and we're figuring it out, we would have these moments where we just stop and be looking at the table and going, it's so weird. It was such a different thought process, a different mental exercise to go through. And, you know, one of the things that I compared it to, and probably said it in the past, is if you've ever played, if you play chess and then you try and play Go, they're so totally different. You know, one is about chess is about movement and being very, very tactical, where Go is about positioning and, you know, territory control. And I'd say that the Warcaster is to War Machine like you know, Go is to chess. It's that different. And that was what we wanted to do. That was, you know, we wanted to create an experience that was very different from War Machine. So it didn't feel like we were just sort of reskinning the whole thing. And that's what we ended up doing.
All right. So we've got one Iron Kingdoms RPG question. It is for the upcoming Iron Kingdoms RPG set, aka Requiem for a Mechanophile's Dream. What the heck is that shark thing? It certainly must have a name. What are some racist subclasses that you're excited to see on the tabletop?
The final name on that crazy shark thing is Brine Thrall. As you can probably infer between the image and that name, these are aquatic creatures that have spent some time on a Necrotex operating table. And so they are super creepy. It's one of my favorite images that we've done for this new expansion of the Nightmare Empire. As far as stuff that's coming up, I mean, the Nightmare Empire is all about Kricks and pirates. So anything that has to do with those, as far as you know, classes and things, it's a real deep dive into just anything that you can find in the Shard Islands.
All right, so we're on to the War Machine section of the interview. Some of the first questions are Orgoth related. First one is, how quote unquote wide are you looking at having the faction be comparable to one of the limited factions, or more in line with what we'd consider a normal army?
So those aren't terms that we use. The Orgoth faction will be limited, but there's a lot more to it than, you know, what we've shown so far. But also, just because something is limited, it doesn't mean that we'll never produce anything for it again. With as many factions as we have between War Machine and Hordes, that just has to be the way things go from now on, because we can't expand 15 factions, you know, in parallel and in perpetuity. So past a certain point, people don't really need more stuff for an army, even if, you know, they're really devoted to it and they want to see something for it. But it just, like, eventually you're going to hit a point of diminishing returns where it doesn't make sense to keep throwing stuff into the same bucket. So back when we did Grimkin, we sort of adopted a new approach to bringing new factions into the game, where we sort of holistically create the faction from the beginning, but we also leave room to add things in the future. It's just not going to be a constant stream of stuff. So when the Orgoth come out, we'll be, you know, you're going to see a lot of it. There's going to be more that we do in the future for it, but it's not going to be something that we, you know, keep expanding over 20 years.
So as a retailer, I would say that Crucible Guard and Grimkin had around a similar number of units, different models that we would stock, and Infernals was slightly a little bit less. Is it looking right now that Orgoth is more around the size of Infernals or one of the other limited factions so far?
Gosh, without like getting everything out and counting it, I don't exactly know. But I'd say, you know, it's probably going to be comparable to something like Crucible Guard. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So next question is, do Orgoth Warjacks have any baseline rules differences in how they operate compared to a normal Warjack?
If you mean like in terms of game mechanics, no, they operate like normal Warjacks.
Okay. Next question is, who is the most badass of the Orgoth Warcasters?
Well, the two that we have shown so far are both super badass, but I think that's a question that's going to be answered by the players once they're on the tabletop.
Next question is, from what we saw of the preview, it looks like the Ulkor and the Reaver units are low model counts. Will Orgoth models tend to be on the higher value side, i.e. lower total model count?
Yeah, so both the Ulkor and the Reavers are 40 millimeter based models, right? So we kept the full unit size a bit more conservative. There, we won't be doing 10 model units for these guys because they're some big chunky warriors.
Is in general, is Preptor Press preferring to do the 5-man units versus 10-man, or does that not really matter?
Not necessarily. I mean, we are trying to be mindful of, you know, how cumbersome something can be to move around or how much space it takes up on a table. And we found that, you know, when models have larger bases, doing, you know, big units with them can be a little bit clumsy.
Will any Felgoth Infernals models show up?
I'm not going to say never anymore because that one always comes back to haunt me, but we don't have any planned. We've really only revealed one aspect of the Orgoth so far, and there's going to be a lot more to this faction in the future. But the Orgoth relationship with the Felgoth is very different than what we've seen between, you know, Infernalists and the Nanokians previously. The Felgoth are much less present. They're sort of, you know, in the background, and they have empowered the Orgoth to basically escape the afterlife and return to battle, but they're not fighting alongside them.
So next question is, when creating a new model / unit / warjack, etc. for War Machine and Hordes, how often do you start with rules and then build around that idea? Or is it always that you start with the character and then build the rules after?
There's no real order of operations for it. We just kind of go with whatever we're inspired for first. Sometimes, you know, there's a hole to fill or a need that a faction has. And so we might have some ideas for rules that need to, need to be present there. And then we'll develop a model for it. Other times we've got a character or a concept that we want to introduce. And we'll, you know, develop the rules we'll figure it out, you know, what it's going to be or, you know, what it adds to the game. We've started with an image before where we, you know, took a piece of artwork that existed or, you know, a brand new illustration and then said, you know, what's this going to be? So there's really no set way that we do things. Our creative process is very organic and really just kind of led by whatever we're creatively inspired by.
All right. So next question is, are the 80mm models coming to all factions?
No, not right away, at least, you know, over time, maybe. It depends on if there's a reason to add an 80mm model to an existing faction. So, I think that we've got some ideas for things that we might do, you know, that we might add to all the factions. The 80mm bases are kind of, it's kind of like having a new canvas to work with. There's a lot of space on there and we can do a lot of neat things with it, but it's not something where we've said, you know, every faction needs to have this size base.
Next listener said, first of all, the models look amazing. I wanted to ask, what's the biggest challenge with bringing the big, quote unquote, boogeymen onto the tabletop?
The biggest challenge? Well, this is the first War Machine army that we made during a pandemic when our team was working remotely. So that slowed development down a bit as we have adapted to this new way. But otherwise, I don't think it's been too much different than any of our past experiences. You know, really our biggest challenge is usually just trying to contain what we're doing so it doesn't grow out of control. Once we get inspired by something, it can be hard to resist the temptation to keep building on it. But otherwise, you know, I think we've been making factions, making models, making games for over 20 years now. So it's kind of just what we do.
So next question is, can we expect to see more model previews soon, or is what we've seen all we will see until the Kickstarter?
Yeah, we're going to have a bunch of new previews in the next episode of Primecast Plus, which is supposed to come out next week. So we're putting that together right now. Yeah, there'll be a bunch of new Orgoth stuff in it. A couple things that that we've, you know, saw in the artwork, but haven't seen the models for yet, like those Rock Harriers that are flying around. And those are super sweet models. And then a couple other things that nobody has seen yet. So
do you have any idea yet when you're hoping to, a rough time frame on when you're hoping to have the Kickstarter go live?
Yes, but I'm not going to say what it is. So,
okay.
because it could move. And at this point, I'm not even going to say for certain that there's going to be a Kickstarter. You know, we have found that there's a lot of great benefits to using Kickstarter, particularly when it comes to planning production and, you know, knowing what we need to produce over a certain time period. Particularly when we're producing stuff on our own, we're working month to month and you don't always know what's coming up. So when we're able to kickstart a project and say, you know, this is how much we have to produce over a certain time period, then that gives us a really nice roadmap. But there's some things about Kickstarter that aren't as advantageous for us. And so it's something that I am weighing right now, and over the next like month or two, I think that we will commit one way or the other as to whether or not it's going to be a project that we take to Kickstarter or whether or not it's something that we just do conventionally. I'd lean towards Kickstarter right now just for the ability to get it out wider, but I don't know exactly if that's going to be what we do or not.
Okay. So next set of questions are kind of related to some stuff going on in the War Machine storyline. The first one is, with the Claiming and Requiem, we saw many iconic casters die, such as Vlad, Gorshade, and Kruger, or ride off into the sunset like the Butcher, Nemo, and Fiora. Did you find the choice to conclude the stories of those characters particularly hard? Who are some up-and-coming characters in the fluff that we should look out for?
No, I wouldn't say it was a difficult choice. You know, we've been spinning a yarn now for 20 years, so it actually felt good to bring some of those characters to their ultimate conclusion. Because, you know, again, if you go too long, things can, you know, get repetitive or redundant. And so the next place we're going with the story is the Orgoth invasion. And so the timeline jumps a few years. We're going to be working with Aaron Riddell again. He's going to be writing the story of that invasion. So we'll get to meet these new Orgoth warcasters and find out all about them. And then, we also got a little peek at a new Signar warcaster in that artwork that we showed off. And so you'll want to keep an eye out for her.
Well, that relates well to another question that's in here. It says, from the teaser in the art, it looks like Signar's next block of models will be Storm Legion. Can you tell some cool tidbits about them? Is the person without a helmet a new warcaster? And if so, what is their name? And then parenthetically, it says, for what it's worth, Scorn and Signar have both gone without a new caster since 2017.
Okay, so we're not keeping score here, right?
Yeah, they totally are.
the character in the center of that Storm Legion force with the lance and shield, she's a new warcaster. We haven't revealed her name yet, and we're not ready to start giving any details about the Storm Legion. But as you can tell from the artwork, they've got some new gear, and they've really mastered the storm tech. So kind of moved beyond steam power with the Storm Legion.
This is kind of a follow-up question with that picture, but and you may have already answered it with that, but any Signar Storm spoilers or hints?
All I'm going to say is we've barely scratched the surface with what we've shown, but they're definitely the next thing that we'll start talking about once the Orgoth have had their time in the spotlight.
Okay. Next, kind of fluff related question is, Kador would seem to be in a not happy place right now. How desperate is the Kadoran army's resistance to the Orgoth invasion?
So keep in mind, this story has not been written yet, right? We're getting ready to dive in with Aaron Riddell soon. And so it's going to be soon, and those questions are going to be answered then. But But as we mentioned in the essays that we've been publishing online, Cador's West Coast is where the Orgoth Sea Raiders first show up. And so they're very much caught on their back foot, totally unprepared. And so what we'll be seeing with Cador is for once Cador is on the defensive, and it's not going to go easy for them.
All right. So next question is, the Warwitch Queen sounds amazing. Any chance we will see art or even a model depicting that?
So probably not a model. She's their matriarch. It'd be like putting the, you know, Anvinar, the Cadoran Empress, on the tabletop. But very possibly at some point we're going to want to do an illustration of her. Yeah.
All right. So a couple questions related to inventory and stuff that you guys are making. First one is there an update on availability of the plastic kits that have been out of stock?
So not so much an update, but I can tell you it's something that we're definitely working on trying to solve. So a little background on it is, we had actually placed a restock order for those plastic kits back before the pandemic hit. I think they delivered just within a few months. I want to say it was kind of like around that September, October before COVID. It took forever to show up. And then when they did, the entire run was defective. They the plastic was soft and rubbery for some reason, and we never really got a good explanation for it. But of course, it wasn't something that we could offer. So before we could get the run replaced, COVID came along, and then things shut down for a long time. And, you know, everything has changed in that time. So the problem is, and this is the issue with plastics produced overseas, is that even though, you know, this is something that we know is important to address and we hear about it a lot, we know that also if we order them right now, we're going to be sitting on a ton of kits that are going to take years and years to sell through, because they're older models and most people have them. And so we're not going to end up moving very many of them. But the factories, you know, that we order this stuff from, they've got set minimum order quantities, right? That are, you know, exponentially more than what we know we would need at the moment. So we're looking at alternate production methods, where we can produce these models internally. But then we've got another problem, and that's that most of those plastic kits that are out of stock were sculpted traditionally, like before we really started going heavy with 3D sculpting. And so so we don't have them anymore to you know, produce in metal or in resin. And that means in order for us to produce them in-house, we've got to re-sculpt the models all over again. So again, we kind of run into this problem of the cost far outweighing what we know the demand is going to be. And so we're working through a few different unconventional solutions on how to address this. It's not something that we're going to have an answer for in the immediate future. But I can say for certain that those out of stock plastic kits are never going to come back in that form that they were, right? Like, it's the solution ahead of us is to find a way to offer those models in some different form, some other material, or, you know, find other ways to sort of plug those holes.
All right. So the final listener question is, on a related note, are there plans for newer updated starter products?
So we will be creating a starter product for the Orgoth. So we'll have a new starter. But again, we're in the same sort of spot as the other plastic kits. But this is a much bigger problem with the starters, because this is how most people are going to get into the game. So ultimately, yes, we are going to create starter products and should have some news on those later this year.
Awesome. Well, thank you to the listeners. I think we had some fantastic questions. I guess before we sign off, is there anything that we didn't think to ask that you've been excited to talk about, or anything that you want to cover, Matt?
No, I think we pretty much did the full 360 there. So
awesome. All right. Well, Matt, thank you very much for your taking time out of your schedule. I know you're a very busy guy, so it's great hearing from you.
Thank you very much for having me on, Jay.
Yeah, you bet. And thank you to all the listeners. You guys are awesome. And everyone go out and play some awesome games.
Play some games. That's right.